Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Tonight, a conversation with the unbeliever. You can look at it many different ways. The skeptic, that person that you meet that does not believe even the most basic and fundamental things that you as a Christian believe. Maybe they don't even believe that there's a God. Or maybe they believe there is a God, but heck, all religions lead essentially to the same place, don't they? That might be a question you find yourself in need of answering when you engage the unbeliever and the skeptic. We're going to be answering some of those questions and objections during this hour of Issues Etc. with Ken Samples of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center. It's Sunday night, July the 25th. We have open lines for the next 2 hours as we discuss answering the objections of unbelievers. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Or you can email us with a question or a comment via our live in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. That address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Ken Samples is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He is founder and president of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center based in Southern California. He is vice president of Philosophical and Theological Apologetics for Reasons to Believe and author of the new book, Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions. Ken, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. It's nice to be with you once again.
Ken, before we get into some of these important questions, and we're only going to be able to skim the surface of this, first of all, do unbelievers, does the skeptic, does he occupy the intellectual high ground? I know that they assume they do when engaging Christians, but should the Christian give in to that assumption?
Well, I don't think the Christian should accept that assumption, because when we look at unbelief, when we look at atheism and the worldview that undergirds atheism, naturalism, that the material world is all there is, there's nothing other than that, no spirituality, no God, etc. It seems to me that what you have in that world are people with cognitive faculties, the brain, and their sensory organs, their eyes and their ears, etc. And they're looking at the world, but essentially they're saying that things like life and personality and human characteristics, the mind, logic, etc., have come from a mechanism, some kind of Darwinian mechanism that lacks all of those faculties and attributes. And so I actually think that Christians are in a very good position to assert that we have a metaphysical basis for things like reason and logic and rationality and truth. And in reality, I think that atheism and unbelief really has a difficult time kind of accounting for things like reason and logic, etc.
Let's start with one of the most basic questions, and that is how anyone can know that God exists.
Well, that's really a great question, and I think the way I would approach that question, and there are, I think, many good ways of approaching it as we see in the history of Christian thought. One of the ways that I think is a powerful way to approach that, Todd, is to say that God is the best explanatory hypothesis. That is, God makes the most sense when it comes to the meaningful realities of life. One of those realities is staring us in the face at this very moment. We call it the universe. Virtually all research physicists now believe that the universe had a distinct beginning, a finite period of time ago, that matter, energy, time, and space had a beginning. I think the reasoning of the Kalam cosmological argument, long time popular in Christian circles, the idea that if anything has a beginning, it must have a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe had a cause. Belief in God, belief in the God of Scripture, belief in the triune God of the New Testament provides an explanation for why there's a universe and why that universe is ordered and the laws of science are regular, why we see patterns. And so I think a good way of arguing this way is to say, look, God explains certain things. He is an explanation for the meaningful realities that we see, and not just the world and the order in it, but also things like abstract non-physical realities like numbers, concepts, moral principles, universals, all of these kinds of things that are made up in the world of ideas. God provides a basis for the things that we see and also a basis for the things that we can't see but are nevertheless real. And so in the first chapter of my book, I suggest that God provides an excellent explanatory hypothesis that maybe we should approach this like we are detectives and we're looking at clues and we ask the question, well, here is the crime scene before me. What explanation explains all of these things? And then, of course, we would have to get down to human beings. Why are human beings the way they are? Why do we strive to have something more than just this life? Why are we sinful? Why are we capable of so many great things? And then I think we also add, how do you explain the person of Jesus Christ, his life, his death, his resurrection? And it seems to me that a powerful way of appealing to God is to say that God is that best explanatory hypothesis for all of these various phenomena that are so meaningful to us in life.
Now, and especially nowadays, Ken, unbelievers and skeptics are not shy about discussing even, sometimes out of ignorance, sometimes they know quite a bit, even the details of Christian theology. And especially with the popularity of movies like Mel Gibson's The Passion, Jesus, of course, has been the subject of many a conversation by believers and unbelievers. But the assumption often is that the Gospels, from which that story is drawn, so many other of the accounts of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, are not reliable historical documents. Make the case that they are.
That's really, I think, a very fair question and a very critical question. But I think, again, history is on the side of the historic Christian at that point. Let me mention just a few details. First of all, when we look at all of the ancient books, we look at books by Plato and Aristotle, for example, along with all of the other Greek and Roman philosophers and historians and writers. When we ask, are these books reliable? Where did they come from? How many copies of these books do we have? What is the distance in time between when these were actually written and the earliest copy that we have? The New Testament is in such a superior state to all of that. When it comes to the ancient works, typically you have a handful of writings of Plato, Aristotle, Caesar, or any number of others. In terms of the New Testament, of Greek manuscripts alone, we have 5,000 copies. So we go from a handful to more than 5,000, more than 8,000 Latin copies, the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate, thousands of other manuscripts in other Eastern languages. So there's just this abundance of manuscript evidence that we have to analyze and work through. And then in terms of time, it makes sense that the closer, the shorter period of time between when a manuscript was written and the copy we have, the better, because there's less time for any changes or legends to creep in. With most of these ancient works that nobody ever questions their authenticity, it may range from 1,000 or more years in terms of the New Testament. We have copies, fragments of the New Testament, that may be just a couple decades from its original writing, and we have full copies of the New Testament within 100 to 200 years. So in terms of manuscript data, in terms of looking at the Bible as a historical document, there is enormous evidence and support that we're dealing with a historical document that has reliability and authenticity. And let me add to this, there is a powerful, I think, corroborating component. When you look at about the dozen people outside of the Bible that wrote about Jesus, Pliny, Suetonius, Josephus, etc. There's about a dozen or so authors, and they write kind of sometimes enigmatic statements, but they write about Jesus. What they have written, however, in the end of the first century and into the second century corroborates quite well with what Christians believed about Jesus, that he came from Judea, he was a miracle worker, He was an extraordinary teacher. He was arrested for blasphemy. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and his disciples declared that they had seen him risen from the dead. Now, none of that proves that the New Testament is correct, but there's nothing in the extra-biblical writings of Roman and Greek authors that goes against Christianity. In fact, it confirms or comports with a great deal of it. So Christians are in a very strong position when it comes to history about the roots of their faith.
Ken Samples is our guest. He's founder and president of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center based in Southern California, vice president of philosophical and theological apologetics for Reasons to Believe, and author of the new book, Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions. We are answering the objections of unbelievers and skeptics during this hour of Issues, Etc. When we come back, we've come now to the real substance of the conversation. If the conversation goes in the right direction with the skeptic and the unbeliever, you will eventually, and you really must eventually, get around to the person of Jesus. So according to those gospel documents that tell us of Jesus Christ, reliable as they are, who did Jesus claim to be? It's even this little legend goes around even among Christians sometimes that Jesus, the subject of those Gospels, never really claimed to be God. We'll find out whether that's true when we come back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does God's law motivate the Christian to do good works? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. The next edition of the Issues, Etc. Journal contains an article titled, Getting Clear on Sanctification. It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Stephen Hine. You can receive a complimentary copy of the next Issues, Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. Plus, I've written an article titled, The Fad-Driven Church. Why are so many pastors worshiping at the altar of novelty? Find out with the Issues, Etc. Journal, 1-800-737-0172. The next issue also details Uwe Simonetto's journey from hedonism to Lutheranism, 1-800-737-0172. Now, if you enjoy Issues, Etc., the radio program, you need to get the Issues, Etc. Journal. Call now, 1-800-737-0172, and ask for a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal. Folks, you can find out more about Ken Samples' new book. It's called Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions on the website for the Augustine Fellowship Study Center. Just go first to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the section titled Links with Regular Guests, and you're going to find a direct link to our guest, Kim Samples, and the Augustine Fellowship Study Center. Or you can also call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172, and we'll give you the phone number and the mailing address for the Augustine Fellowship Study Center, 1-800-737-0172. Ken, did Jesus portray himself, claim to be, and believe himself to be God based upon the documents that we have extant of his life and his sayings and his deeds?
The answer to that question is definitely yes. Let's look a little bit, first of all, at the way Jesus saw himself in relationship to God the Father. In my book, I illustrate a number of ways in which Jesus does this very thing of equating himself with Yahweh, the Lord God. In John, the Gospel, to know Jesus is to know God, John 14. To see Jesus is to see God. Jesus says, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. He also says in John 14, believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Another passage in the same chapter of John, to trust in Jesus is to trust in God. You've trust in God, trust also in me. To honor Jesus is to honor God. To hate Jesus is to hate God. To come to Jesus is to come to the Lord God. To love Jesus is to love God. So clearly, one of the clear evidences that Jesus saw himself as having a unique, special, one-of-a-kind relationship with God was that he told his disciples and those who were his enemies that how they related to him was ultimately how they were relating to God himself. And very clearly, the reason why Jesus was arrested and tried, found guilty and crucified, was for the charge of blasphemy. There are numerous places in the New Testament where Jesus claims to have a unique and special relationship with God the Father. He says this to the Sanhedrin at his trial. He says this on numerous occasions in his dialogues with Jewish leaders. And again, they pick up stones to stone him because he claims to be the great I Am. And this expression, I Am, is very significant. In the book of Isaiah, particularly starting with chapter 41, this expression, I Am, or I Am He, is one of the most sacred expressions in the entire Old Testament in terms of who God is, God's self-designation. Jesus, on numerous occasions, refers to himself as the great I Am. And it's true that Jesus never says the specific words, I am God, but he says virtually that when he uses this expression of I Am. And the Jews recognize this appeal to deity because they pick up stones to stone him, the penalty for blasphemy.
Now, this kind of leads us to an area of the conversation with the skeptic where they might not be as knowledgeable as the Christian, because a Christian, in order to be a Christian, really does need, at the very least, to have a rudimentary understanding of Christ's dual nature. He is both God and man.
Right.
Well, the skeptic may not have that understanding, but he might ask a very legitimate question, which is, come on, two natures. You are presenting a insoluble paradox here, and just tell me how he can be both at the same time.
Right, and that, of course, is a very challenging question. When it comes to Christianity, we are faced with a God that transcends us, a God that we cannot fully comprehend. We can have a relationship with him. We can understand his nature, but we can never know him as he knows himself. Yet there's nothing in the doctrine of the Incarnation, the second person of the Trinity, the eternal Word, coming and taking a human nature. God in the flesh is the meaning of that term, incarnation. There's nothing contradictory about that. We're not saying that God was the infinite somehow was contained in the finite. That would be a contradiction. Rather, what we're saying is that God has an infinite divine nature, and he didn't give up any of the attributes or qualities that make him divine. Yet he took to himself a human nature. And so the incarnation is not God minus or somehow the infinite contained within the finite. Rather, the incarnation is God plus. Jesus has a divine nature, which is infinite by nature. And then he took to himself a human nature, which has real limitations. Certainly, this is unusual. This is an incredible claim. Yet it is not. It is not irrational. It's not saying it's A and non-A. And so I like to argue the point that Christian theology often transcends human reason, but it never violates human reason. Nothing in the incarnation is really a formal logical contradiction.
Although it can certainly appear to be so.
Right.
Would it be safe to say then, what appears to be a logical contradiction, that there is a single person possessed of two complete natures at the same time, a personal union of those two natures in one person, what appears to be the logical contradiction derives from our inability to understand the other half of that equation, which is the God part of that equation.
That's right. I think it's when we talk about the hypostatic union, a theological term referring to the unity of Jesus' two natures in his personhood, this is obviously something that is far beyond our ability to fathom or to totally comprehend. Yet I think the answer to all of these questions is that we are dealing with a God that transcends our understanding. And it is in his greatness and in his glorious acts of redemption that we find the answers to these. Yet again, I want to assert to the non-believer that there's no logical contradiction. There's no formal contradiction here. It's one thing to say, I don't understand it. I can't comprehend it. It's another thing to say, it's actually logically contradictory and can't be true.
With only 2 minutes here and barely 2 minutes before our next break, let's get into the perhaps most important question. Actually, let's save it for the other side of the break. We're going to deal with the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Did Jesus actually rise from the dead? Now, here is where the skeptic and the unbeliever, where their alternate theories for what really happened there and what accounts for an empty tomb, they multiply, and they might toss them at you in rapid-fire succession. Hopefully, on the other side of the break, we'll have the opportunity to be able to answer many of those objections to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It occurs to me, why not give a non-Christian friend, a relative, a co-worker, a tape of this two-hour broadcast with Ken Samples on answering the objections of unbelievers? Here's how you can go about getting that free tape. Get a pen and a piece of paper ready, because you should hear an announcement with a phone number and a mailing address for the local church that sponsors issues, etc., for you, and they'll send you a free cassette recording. Now, you should hear an announcement with some contact information for that local church sponsor right after the Issues, Etc. close theme. When we come back, we'd like to take your phone calls, your questions, and your comments as well. 1-800-730-2727. The best callers in the next 90 minutes with Ken Samples will receive a copy of his new book called Without a Doubt. 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin, and you're listening to Issues, Etc. When we come back, what do we need to know as Christians when we engage the unbeliever and the skeptic about the central claim, the central truth claim of Christianity, and that is the resurrection, the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ? Do we need to be able to answer, well, some of the alternate explanations that people are wont to come up with? Did Jesus merely swoon? Was his body stolen? Is this a myth conjured up long after the fact by pious Christians wanting to come up with some explanation for what the disciples certainly couldn't understand, an empty tomb after the death of their master? We'll answer all of those on the other side of the break. One writer has called fascism the capitalist version of communism. Is fascism merely a political and economic theory? How has fascism found a home both in Anything Goes America and in Islamic nations? You'll find the answer to that question in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Modern Fascism, The Threat to the Judeo-Christian Worldview, by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Jean Edward Veith. Find out more about modern fascism by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for information on the book, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for Modern Fascism by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again. I'm talking with the author of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for July, Modern Fascism, Dr. Jean Edward Veith. Ed, where do you see fascism today?
Well, what we're dealing with right now in the war on terrorism is a war against fascism. Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party that ruled Iraq and that still rules Syria and still has a very big following in the Arab world, literally is a fascist party that developed out of the 40s. It's Arab fascism. And Saddam Hussein is exactly, in his ideology as well as his practices, in that tradition of Hitler, Mussolini, and others. But the Islamic fascism, you'll see this described, commentators, some of them are using the term Islamofascism, which is a very precise and accurate description of their philosophy. It's an Islamic fascism that seeks to create this perfect Islamic state in this world, and end that acknowledges no transcendent moral law to restrict what they're willing to do to people.
So it sounds like you're saying fascism isn't dead.
It's still with us, and it's with us in not only those overt literal fascism that the terrorists and Saddam Hussein exemplify, but the postmodernist thought that's so common today, the idea that truth is relative, that the truth is a construction of the will, that morality is nothing more than an imposition of power, and all these things that we've dealt with, that can be traced in a direct, literal line back through the fascist philosophers of the 30s and the 20s and in the origins in the thought of Friedrich Nietzsche, who is an important thinker for both the fascist movement and is very much in vogue in universities today.
Find out more about our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Modern Fascism, The Threat to the Judeo-Christian Worldview by Dr. Gene Edward Veith by going online to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on modern fascism. You can also order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Modern Fascism. 1-800-325-3040. Next week on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss sanctification, the Christian life, with Dr. Stephen Hine. Do Christians, can they look forward to significant, ongoing, ever-increasing victory over sinful behavior? Is there a relationship between God's blessings and your obedience to the Ten Commandments? And while we're on that subject, does God's law motivate Christians to do good works? We'll talk about all of that next week on Issues Etc. with Dr. Stephen Hine. Now, if you'd like to know what we'll be discussing throughout August, check out our website, issuesetc.org. While you're there at the website, be sure to find out more about our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July. It's called Modern Fascism, The Threat to the Judeo-Christian Worldview, and it's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Gene Edward Veith. This book explores not only the history of fascism, but also its present-day reality, especially in postmodern America. Now, you can browse before you buy the book at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. You'll find Modern Fascism. It costs $17.99 plus shipping and handling. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. Now, when you call, make sure you mention Issues Etc. and our Book of the Month for July, Modern Fascism, 1-800-325-3040. Ken Samples is our guest as we talk about answering the objections of unbelievers. He is president and founder of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center based in Southern California, vice president of philosophical and theological apologetics at Reasons to Believe, and author of the new book, Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions. Let's talk about the resurrection of Jesus Christ and that central truth claim. And I think we've discussed this before in different conversations, Ken, that this is one of those points where Christianity differs from other world religions in that if one can disprove the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and if it simply isn't true, then Christianity isn't true and entirely falsified.
Yeah, that is a very unique point, and I think a helpful point. I remember debating an atheist at the University of California, Irvine, some 10 years ago, and in the course of the debate, I said to my atheist opponent, I said, you know, there is a way of invalidating, disproving Christianity, and that is to show that the resurrection did not take place, is not true, is not factual. So I turned the tables around and said, now, what would disqualify your faith? That is, what would I have to prove to you to show you that atheism is false? His response was, nothing you could say would ever change my mind. And at that point, I thought, well, why are we debating if there's no way to show one position to be untrue and another position to be superior? The resurrection is that issue, no doubt about it.
Okay, let's briefly summarize the evidence for And then we'll answer some of the objections against the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The evidence for first, Ken.
Yeah, there is a number of important strands. I call it the six strands of evidence for the resurrection. Number one, the empty tomb. The tomb of Jesus is empty. It comes to us from early sources that the tomb on Easter Sunday morning is empty. Jesus' body is missing. The Romans and the Jews have the motive, they have the opportunity and all of the resources to find the body of Jesus if it's hidden in another tomb, yet they cannot. And so the first strand of evidence in support of the resurrection is Jesus' body is not in the tomb, and that body cannot be located, it cannot be produced. And again, if it could have been, that would have squashed Christianity right from the get-go. There would be no Christian church or Christian movement to deal with, yet the tomb is empty. And it's impossible for the apostles to have preached the resurrection of Jesus if somebody could have gone over to the tomb and discovered the body. A very strong evidence in support of the resurrection is the body is gone, the tomb is empty. A second strand of evidence, equally powerful, is what I call the post-crucifixion appearances. There are more than a dozen appearances of Jesus to various people in the New Testament after his crucifixion on the cross. He appears to numerous people, small groups, large groups. Paul the Apostle says that he appeared to more than 500 brethren on a single occasion. He appears to just a couple of the disciples, all of the disciples. He appears to people who are close and friendly to him. He also appears to people who are ambivalent or hostile to him, including his stepbrother James, and then later the Saul of Tarsus, who will become the Apostle Paul, indoors, out of doors, in a variety of circumstances. And so these people are seeing something. He appeals to their awareness of the five senses. See the marks in my of the cross in my body, touch and see. And so the apostles were having real experiences, and that needs some explanation. And hallucination and things like that can explain that body of varied evidence. Thirdly, the transformation of the apostles. One of the things that I think makes a person want to embrace the apostles' writings is that they freely admit their weaknesses, their frailties, their sins. They don't embellish and make themselves look very good. And the reality, when Jesus was arrested and crucified, they acted in a rather cowardly fashion. Yet, not long after that, they become these bold and tenacious preachers of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And they say that the courage to stand against anything the Roman Empire and hostile Jews could throw at them was because they had encountered the risen Christ. So if the resurrection didn't happen, how do we explain this transformation of human character in the apostles? And then maybe even more to the next strand, Saul of Tarsus. Here is a leading intellectual Jew of the first century, a scholar of the Old Testament, hostile to Christianity, sees it as a cult or a sect that needs to be stamped out, desires to arrest Christians and even approves of Christians being put to death, yet he says that he encountered Christ on the road to Damascus. His life is changed. Out of that comes the greatest theologian in the history of Christianity, Christianity's greatest missionary, possibly as well their greatest apologist. So how do we explain the change in the Apostle Paul's life? Fifth strand, the emergence of the church. If Christ had not raised, where did the church come from? Why is the church there? It needs a cause or explanation. The apostles constantly said the church was built around the truth of the resurrection. The resurrection was at the centerpiece of apostolic preaching. Finally, the sixth piece, why did Sunday become important? Why was there a change or a switch to Sunday in terms of meeting and celebrating the Lord's Supper? Why does Sunday have any significance at all? Because Sunday, the first day of the week, is the day that commemorates the resurrection of Jesus. So in reflection, the resurrection changes theological and doctrinal ideas within Christianity and sets it apart from Judaism. So here are six strands of evidence that Christian thinkers, theologians, apologists, and philosophers have used through the centuries to argue that all of these need an explanation, and that we believe the best explanation is that Jesus actually rose physically and bodily from the dead.
Folks, you're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're ready to take your phone calls on answering the objections of unbelievers. Our number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live this Sunday evening. It's July the 25th. 1-800-730-2727. We'll give the best callers to the program a copy of Ken Sample's new book called Without a Doubt. 1-800-730-2727. We also have that in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, 1-800-730-2727. Ken, let's deal with some of the alternate explanations for the empty tomb. One, there simply wasn't an empty tomb. However, the resurrection, pretty much the whole scenario, was a later addition, a later extrapolation by either the apostles or by their successors in an attempt to make more of Jesus than he really was.
The reason this hypothesis or this explanatory theory doesn't work is really, I think, broadly an issue of time. The Gospels appear relatively quickly. That is, there's good reason to believe that the Synoptic Gospels all may have been in existence and circulating within the Church as early as possibly the 60s of the first century. And that is at a time, Todd, when people are still living. Remember, Jesus' crucifixion death is approximated at about 30 A.D., by 60 A.D., there are still plenty of people living who knew about these events. If the apostles had exaggerated or embellished or changed the story, there were plenty of people around who were hostile to them and who would have loved to have pointed out this kind of inconsistency. And so, really, the idea of myths and legends creeping in to distort historical fact is a very difficult idea, as long as there are eyewitnesses living who know this to be false. And so one of the powerful reasons for accepting the authenticity of what the Gospels say about Christ is that they were written at a time when people were in a position to know, and they appeal to the firsthand knowledge of their hearers. They say, these things weren't done in a corner. These are things that you know. And so legend and myth, I think, would take many generations apart from the historical events in order to have any kind of explanatory power.
Now, when we come back from this break, we'll take your questions and your comments at 1-800-730-2727. We'll also, as time permits, deal with perhaps the most important question, along with the other hypotheses on the resurrection, most important question, which is, why did Jesus have to die and rise again? All of that when we come back from this break. Our guest is Ken Samples. By the way, he has several articles that we have posted at our website, issuesetc.org. If you look under the What's New section, you'll find these articles on defending the Christian faith at our website, issuesetc.org. When we come back, the disciples, this one seems most reasonable to me. I'm not a skeptic. I'm not an unbeliever. But, you know, this is the one that would, if I were a lawyer looking at the case, I'd say, well, the most logical explanation is that the disciples simply came to the tomb surreptitiously by night before the women got there on the first day of the week. And the whole account can stay completely intact except for Jesus' post-resurrection appearances. They just came and took the body. In fact, doesn't Mary wonder that someone's taken the body when she finds an empty tomb? They've taken my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him. She jumps to the most reasonable explanation for an empty tomb. Why is this not a good explanation, an alternate explanation to the resurrection? We'll find out why when we come back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you enjoy listening to Issues Etc. on the weekends, did you know that you can listen to 12 new hours of Issues Etc. each week on the Internet? All you have to do is go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the worldwide KFUO logo, and there you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7, including 12 new programs weekly. The website address again, issuesetc.org.
Issues Etc. is looking for one member from each Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation to become our official lay representative. Responsibilities simply involve promotion of Issues Etc. in your local church. Now, if you're interested, leave your name, phone number, and mailing address, and your congregation's name, city and state, on our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172, or email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org. If you would like to know how to contact our guest in this hour, Ken Samples and the Augustine Fellowship Study Center, or if you'd like to become our Issues Etc. lay representative in your local Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation, or if you'd like to help us defend the faith and teach the truth by joining our Issues Etc. Reformation Club, it's our monthly donor program. You can call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. The address again, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Very briefly, before we go to the phones here, Ken, why couldn't the disciples simply have stolen the body?
Yeah, the theory really is implausible for the following reasons. Number one, how would the disciples steal the body? They'd have to get past the Roman guards, not an easy task. They'd have to move the stone. And remember, we're talking about people who acted extremely cowardly at the time of Jesus' death. How would they accomplish all that? Secondly, what would be their motivation? I mean, these are first century Jews. These are people who have cut their teeth on the Torah. They realize that they can get into serious trouble by making blasphemous claims about Jesus. What did they have to gain by this? What did they get? Hardship, persecution. And they may even be executed for this kind of thing. And as first century Jews, they may face God's wrath by creating false statements about God. So what do they have to, what motivates them to do this? It seems that they have nothing to gain by doing this kind of thing. And it also seems to me that, again, the apostles are very candid about their own frailties and their own difficulties. They tell us, for example, that Jesus appeared to women. Now, that may strike people, why is that important? Well, in the first century, women weren't considered the most credible people in a courtroom. That is, when we read the Gospels, it appears that these are not fantasies. This is not Dante or Tolkien. These are the clear memories of people who have had an authentic experience. And so I see no reason to believe that that the apostles could have done this or would have done this, and that the explanation has to be found elsewhere.
Let's talk with some listeners. The first one, Rochelle, listens in Kansas City on KCCV. Rochelle, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Hold on a second here. I'm sorry.
I think we'll go back to Rochelle at a different time here. Sounds like we lost her. Let's talk with Roy, who's calling from Michigan City, Michigan. He listens on XM Radio. Roy, welcome.
How you doing?
Very well.
My question is, every time I try to evangelize, the biggest question that comes up is, how can an all-knowing, all-powerful God allow things, the suffering of the world?
That is a big question, Roy. Let's deal with it here in our last few minutes. What about the problem of evil, Ken?
Well, it's a big problem, and it's a challenging problem. Some would consider it Christian theism's greatest challenge. My response is that it is a difficult issue, but I think Christianity has very powerful answers to the problem of evil. Let's take just a couple ideas. When atheists say to me, or non-believers, skeptics, or agnostics, God can't exist because there's too much evil in the world. My question to them is, how do you know the world is evil? What standard, what basis, what moral guideline are you embracing in order to judge the fact that things like war and rape and genocide are evil? That is, it seems to me that when we say that there are evil things in the world, and there clearly are, the Holocaust, all kinds of murder and mistreatment of human beings in the world, but when we say that those things are evil, not just inconvenient, not just personally distasteful to us, but when we say those things are evil, what Hussein did to his own people was evil, or what Hitler did was evil, or Chairman Mao, we're using a standard, and my question is, where does that standard come from? Could it be, as Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga has pointed out, that the problem of evil actually points to some kind of standard that God provides for us to, in fact, judge what is evil? And so I think there is the problem of the good. I turn it around and ask the unbeliever, what about the problem of the good? How is it that you have any standard at all in which to judge evil? Secondly, I think we can also argue that God, in his sovereignty, will not allow any evil act that he doesn't have a greater purpose for. Now, sometimes that isn't very satisfying to people when they've lost a child or when they've been a victim of crime. But what I want to communicate to them is sometimes the greatest good can come out of the greatest evil. The crucifixion of God in human flesh on the cross, an unjust, evil action, nevertheless made redemption for human beings possible. And so, according to the Gospels, God will not allow any evil to take place that he cannot bring a greater purpose of good out of. And so, the problem of evil is a challenge. The problem of evil is multifaceted. Yet I think the answers to the problem of pain and suffering and evil are powerfully responded to in the Christian faith.
Roy, I'd like you to call back if you would. I'd like to send you a copy of Ken Sample's new book called Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions. Now, finally here, Ken, you have the skeptic's ear and the unbeliever's attention. And you alluded to this just a moment ago. This is very important. Why did Jesus have to die and rise again? I give you 2 minutes.
Well, this is really the heart of the Christian faith. I was a student at Concordia University in Irvine, and my theology professors talked frequently about the cross of Christ. There are many things that we can know about God from creation, many powerful things about his nature. But when we come to know God personally, dynamically, intimately, it's through the cross of Christ. Why did Jesus have to die? Because human beings are sinful. It's not that sin is just a bad habit. Sin is a condition. We don't sin because we're sinners. The problem with sin, I should say, is very, very deep. It comes out of our heart. It has condemned us. We've broken the commandments of God. We're guilty before the Almighty. Jesus Christ comes to earth, and he lays down his life. The Father can choose to punish us because he's just, because he's holy, yet Jesus is our substitute. He suffers the wrath of God in our place. And so the Father's wrath is satisfied, it is appeased because of the death of Christ, yet sinners like you and I are able to escape and receive mercy. We also see other metaphors in Scripture about the atonement of Jesus Christ.
Only about 30 seconds here.
Jesus dies as a propitiation. He appeases the wrath of God. He reconciles us to the Father. And then finally, one metaphor that's very meaningful, Todd, to you and me. God acquits us in the divine courtroom because of the life, death, and resurrection, because of Jesus' righteousness that he imputes to me. I can stand before God righteous in his presence. And so sin is the reason why Christ must come and reconcile humanity back to a holy God.
Folks, we're coming to you live on this Sunday night. It's July the 25th. We'll continue to give away copies of Ken Sample's new book called Without a Doubt to the best callers in the next hour as our conversation continues. 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or you can always email us with your question or comment. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section of the website, and there you'll find that in-studio email address for your questions and your comments. And be sure to tune in live in the next hour on the Internet. Same website, issuesetc.org. Click on the worldwide KFUO logo that you find there. The next hour's conversation on answering the objections of unbelievers will only be broadcast on the Internet, issuesetc.org. 1-800-730-2727. Call during this break. If you're getting a busy signal, keep trying. We'll be freeing up phone lines. 1-800-730-2727. Remember this when dealing with all of these questions with the skeptic, and really we ought to remember, unbeliever. The problem is that they don't believe. Now, we can't reason them into the kingdom of God. We cannot reason them into the faith. But we can, armed with the facts, give them those facts, the central facts of why Jesus had to die as the penalty for our sin, that he has risen again as our Savior, as God's seal upon the fact that that penalty has been completely paid, and he has made peace between us and God through that death and resurrection. Now, those facts, those aren't just facts. Those are facts that save. Those are facts that bring people to faith in Jesus Christ and make of an unbeliever and a skeptic a believer, a Christian. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen to Pastor Todd Wilkin weekly on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. Visit us this week on the World Wide Web. Our website address, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.